Welcome to Nutmeg Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk. Amy Nowrocki is a professor of English at the University of Bridgeport and is a published author and poet. Her collections include Four Blue Eggs and Reconnaissance, both published by Homebound Publications. Her latest work is a memoir, a personal tale where the protagonist is in a coma for 6 months. We'll discuss her literary work, especially the memoir, The Comet's Tale, A Memoir of No Memory, and so much more here on Nutmeg Chatter. Welcome to Nutmeg Chatter, Amy Nowrocki.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Now, this is not the first conversation we've had or interview we've had.
That's right.
In a prior iteration of Nutmeg Chatter, when it was simply the online written work, I interviewed you, but I had the pleasure of interviewing you here at WAPJ Studios.
That's right.
And then we were able to record your work. Two wonderful poems, and so that's also up on nutmegchatter.com, so people can go back and look. But this particular interview, this is our first Nutmeg Chatter as a radio show interview, and I'm so excited to talk to you about The Comet's Tale, because this is a story I did not know about you, and I did not know about you at the time that I interviewed you.
That's right. It's not something that I publicize. I mean, it wouldn't be the first thing you would know about me if we just met. And part of the reason is it was 25 years ago, and it's a time when, well, I've moved on from there, frankly. Mm-hmm. I have written about it in poems, and certainly at the time and past it, I was writing journal entries,
yes,
which factor into the memoir to some extent. But so it didn't define me, or it doesn't define me anymore. But for various reasons, I chose to write about it.
I mean, it must be a very seminal moment in your life. I mean, because this is a type of event that is a game changer, a life changer, and not everybody goes through this particular, people go through different things
right.
in life. This particular event is not a common occurrence for people in life.
And that was interesting to me, and also one of the reasons why I didn't write about it for so long. It was and continues to be one of the most important things that has happened to me, the significant. Mm-hmm. It was life-changing in that way. On the other hand, as the title hints at, I don't remember it. So there you have a somewhat of a problem, particularly as a writer. How do I, and I ask this question to myself and pose it in the beginning, how do I write a memoir about something that I don't have memory of, that I don't remember? I remember in pieces, and I remember parts of it a little bit before, after, but the bulk of it, the part of it that is the event, I have no memory of.
But I think when you, and it's very well written, obviously, I mean, you're a professor of English, but it you know, sets kind of this mystery into place, and it sets it from the standpoint of, you know, setting it up front. We're not spoiling it at the beginning of, because it's about the protagonist, as I said, who has 6 months that she's in a coma. You bring the reader back to an earlier time with some journal entries. Mm-hmm. And it seems in the journal entries that you can look at it in hindsight and then say, you know what, there's some foreshadowing here, but at the time, you didn't recognize it.
I certainly did not.
Right.
I got sick when I was 19. I had just finished my first year of college. And so the journals you're reflecting on were of that time. So they become my means to get into the story as much as a means to process it. And it's true, at the time I was writing very, I'll just use the word cerebrally, which wasn't different from what I usually was as a writer. I was trying things out. It was my first exploration into poetry. The journals weren't poetry, but they were meant to be stream of consciousness. They were meant to be practice space, a literary journal, a creative workspace. And I treated him that way. But I was a college student. I was trying to figure out how to be a college student and how to deal with roommates, dining halls, classes.
Oh, yeah.
So that creeps in, too. And it's a lot. And all of that is happening at a time when I really didn't feel like I fit in. It was a hard transition for me in many ways, and I didn't expect it to be because I really loved school and I was strong academically, but I wasn't strong socially in that and dealing with all of that. So that comes out in the journals. But as in the timeline of the event that would happen that June, looking back again from the perspective of hindsight, my journal entries started to be strange as I got closer and closer to what I would know later was the sickness. And I meant them at the time to be metaphor. Mm-hmm. I meant them to be just letting out things that were on my mind. And the page was the way that I did that.
Well, you describe yourself as living in your head. And right, this is before the sure. actual event, that you were that type of individual who right. did live in her head. And obviously, by virtue of the fact that you were writing journals before this mm-hmm. event, that kind of shows kind of the creative person that you are, but also somebody who has ideas that she wishes to share. Mm-hmm. Something that, of course, now later in life, I mean, you write poetry that are collected in published works and write nonfiction. Mm-hmm. A lot of nonfiction is about Connecticut and about kind of historical mm-hmm. or food,
right.
You know, those type of ideas. This is a very personal book, a very individual book,
right.
Telling your story. That's why, and it's so fascinating. It's fascinating to read. When you were younger, mm-hmm. What prompted you to get the journals in the first place? Or were you always a journaler?
No, I wasn't always a journaler. I kept a notebook from probably the time I was about 15 or 16. But most of that was I would find quirky sayings and I would write them down. Song lyrics mm-hmm. were a lot of those early journals are just recordings of, you know, Sting and Peter Gabriel and things like that.
Sure.
Just music that I, but that brought me into the world of poetry because I would read Yeats or something and I would just copy down a verse. So that's what my journaling was like before I got to college. My first year, my poetry teacher introduced the idea of a journal as a separate thing from classwork. And she didn't make it a requirement. She just said, try this out, you know, mm-hmm. because writing is the path to writing, the path to thinking, and a path to poetry for me. So I really got into it. And I think it actually helped in many ways, not just from the perspective of what I was writing as a poet, but it gave me an outlet to just kind of let loose, to be myself in a way that I felt like I couldn't with new people I was meeting. It allowed me to declare on paper the frustrations I was feeling. So it actually became a process, a mental processing means. And secondary to that at the time was figuring out poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you didn't expect college to be the transition that it
right.
was. What do you think made that transition difficult, or was it part of the physical thing that started manifesting itself at that time?
I don't think so. I don't think it was that I was, you know, getting sick all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, part of it is that idea of I live in my head a lot. I'm not very social. It's hard for me. In high school, I had a good strong core of friends mm-hmm. that I had been building since I was in elementary school. And, you know, we went to high school together. We were growing up together.
Mm-hmm.
And once you go into college, that is, it's not gone because we kept in touch. And some of those friends that I had in high school and were so important to me in high school were the very friends that came to visit me when I was sick.
Yes.
But at the transition from going from that strength of friendship in high school to new people was difficult. I think it was more challenging than I thought it would be. And then couple that with I was pretty shy, confident academically and confident mentally in terms of my abilities academically, but not very social. And so it was hard for me to try to fit in with when you're in it, it seems like everybody's doing better than you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody was sophisticated and able to make connections with people immediately. I mean, that actually wasn't the case at all.
Yeah.
But that's what I perceived it as. Part of it was that. Part of it was I was still, my mother had died a couple years earlier. And it was actually hard to leave my family. My dad was at home. I had three brothers at home. My sister had gone away to college. So I felt possibly guilt over that. Also, I was processing grief still.
Yeah.
So combine all of that into your first year of college, and not atypically, I had a struggle. Yeah.
Well, there was, and we're going to pick this up in the second part of the because we're already at a first break, if you believe. But there's a clearly a strong family, a strong family there that's mm-hmm. really a core mm-hmm. in helping you get better. They are clearly integral to this story.
Absolutely.
And we're going to get to that, but you also mentioned your friends as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one section in your book where you have a visitor, a friend, and her dad is there, the person's dad is there, and you just simply say Happy Thanksgiving and then everyone's kind of surprised by that.
A lot of that was told to me later. But yeah, my family and my friends, that group of friends that I was talking about from high school were, I believe, pivotal to helping me recover through their dedication to me. That's
amazing. Well, tell you what, we're already at first break. We come back, we're going to talk more about that, the family, that helped get you through this time, so much more. We're talking with Amy Naraki and The Comet's Tale, a memoir of no memory. We'll be back in just a few moments here on Nutmeg Chatter. Welcome back to Nutmeg Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk. Here in studio is Amy Naraki. She is the author of The Comet's Tale, a memoir of no memory. Amy Naraki is also a professor at the University of Bridgeport, and she has an extensive work of poetry, including Four Blue Eggs and Reconnaissance, which I've talked about on Nutmeg Chatter previously. Now, Professor Naraki,
yes.
In terms of the diagnosis and what happened, I guess the question I have for you is, what happened to you medically, is that something that somebody could either prepare for, or is it more of recognizing symptoms?
That was the challenge at the time. From what I know, both from what I was told at the time or when I began to come out of it, and when I was searching through medical records, which was another part of the process of getting this book to be written, the diagnosis at the time was viral encephalitis, or encephalitis of presumed viral origin.
Mm-hmm.
But that was part of the strangeness of writing this memoir about myself, is finding out by looking at medical documents it wasn't so much a guess, but just as you were saying, you look at the symptoms, you look at how is this patient, what signs does she show, and just triangulate to the most reasonable diagnosis. And as I was reading through these medical records, they would always be, the language was very repetitive after a while. And they would start off with the patient's history. The 19-year-old female was admitted to the emergency room, then transferred to, at first they thought it was something psychological. I was in the neuropsych ward at first.
Mm-hmm.
I was exhibiting erratic behavior. I'm sure they thought it was a drug related. Many people did. My brother even told me that that's what they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that turns out to be not the presumed cause, well, what else do we have? From my understanding, encephalitis is a catch-all term. What it means, it's brain fever.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that can cause it, as well as, a diversity of ways that it can affect you. This is 25 years ago. This is 1992 when I went into the hospital. Even now, I think they have much better diagnosis means, more information. There's also a lot of more degrees of encephalitis, if you will. We know more about things like West Nile. We know that was not, or even Lyme, Lyme disease. Those were possibilities, but so for many reasons, it wasn't pinpointed exactly, other than encephalitis of presumed viral origin. But there was also a question, okay, so if we all agree that this is what this patient has,
yes.
A second question then is, well, how did you get it? My family was asked questions like, has she been out, you know, out of, has she gone away? Mm-hmm. What was she doing at school? Which they didn't know.
They don't know because really, you're not there. Right, exactly.
And that's where the journals began to become interesting. Yeah. But even there, I didn't say anything like, oh, we went to blah, blah, blah and did this. And I had just gotten a tattoo, so that was maybe a potential mm-hmm. cause.
In fact,
so there
in the
was
book
a lot
you,
of mysteries.
In the book, you wrote that you had gotten a tattoo, but they didn't know about it yet.
Right.
So they knew about it then. Right.
Yeah, I wasn't going to, I didn't want to have that conversation with my dad because he was a Navy guy and he prided himself on never getting a tattoo. So I actually was, strangely enough, spared of that conversation because he found out, probably in the worst possible way. But
right.
But that's something that you can point to and say, well, maybe that was it. But so that encephalitis, I think, was just the most reasonable diagnosis. And then that just carried through.
In fact, earlier in your book, you were writing in some of your journal entries about the idea that you had sold your gallbladder for tickets to Spinal Tap. And even though that wasn't a literal story, it's something that was interesting that they looked at, that you certainly looked at in hindsight, and you said, wow, now we're talking about Spinal Taps in real life.
Right.
And that...
Which was eerie.
Yeah.
And I've read those journals before. I mean, I didn't just pick them up again. I keep them, and I've looked through them before. So I knew that the kinds of things I had written about. And I knew also, we were talking about family a minute ago, my cousin Nancy, who was a doctor herself, she's probably about 20 years older than I am. And my father called her because she was a doctor, and she came from California to be with me, not as a doctor, but as a relative.
Sure.
But her insight as a doctor was really helpful to my father, especially, who really was just spinning because he didn't...
Right. It throws them for a loop.
Diagnosis or not, what do you do now? And she was actually the one who gathered my journals from college and started looking through them and noticing those kind of strange passages. But neither she nor I now made a connection which says I was in a state of sickness at the time when I wrote them, or that they showed something that I wasn't able to understand consciously. I think they were just really explorations of metaphor.
And there was certainly an unusual, you were just talking about the, once you were past the coma portion of it, but mm-hmm. your family had to transition from the family waiting for the diagnosis to then become caregivers. And that was a whole other struggle and challenge for the family, but they pulled together.
Right. So the way I structured the memoir was to thinking of that idea of how can I write this because I don't remember the main events, mm-hmm. was to rely on things like my family's recollections. But then I needed the plot. And once I had made the decision that the pieces that I really do start to remember, that might be another story, another day. I really wanted it to be not vague for the sake of vague, but just to show that it was a transition, both coming out of the actual coma, mm-hmm. which I'm still not sure of how much of a coma I was in for how long. I have no concrete memory for 6 months.
Yes.
But I was awake enough or well enough or the hospital could do as much as they could do. This is Yale University, or Yale New Haven Hospital. I'm not going to be an inpatient there anymore, and they needed to transition me to rehabilitation hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember very little about that transition. I remember nothing about the actual transition. And my family and my friends tell me about pieces that happen during the early parts of rehabilitation. But I start to emerge in terms of my memory getting stronger and crisper 6 months after the initial lights out.
And that's a long time to be lights out. Yeah.
But the coming out of it was slow.
Yeah.
And it would, you know, I progressed quickly, I think, eventually, in rehabilitation. But then my family had to no longer deal with the daughter who is really can't do anything and is that's a very hard thing to deal with. But then here's a daughter who's awake and conscious and saying hi and waving, but can't, you know, she needs to be in a rehabilitation facility to make all that to do the day-to-day living.
Well, tell you what, we're already at our second break.
Wow.
Would you believe? When we come back, let's talk about the inspiration for writing the book and how important it is for people to do their own memoirs, and what specifically inspired you to write the story now, and how did this event shape the person that you became. So we'll talk about all that when we come back in our third segment here on Nutmeg Chatter. Welcome back to Don't Make Chatter. I'm J. Timothy Quirk here with Amy Naraki. We're talking about The Comet's Tale, a memoir of no memory. It is a little-bound book from the essay series of Homebound Publications. Now, we're talking about the memoir of no memory. What inspired you to write this book now?
It actually is really simple in that I was given the opportunity to do it. I did have to choose to do this story. You mentioned Little Bound, and this is an imprint from the publisher. And the publisher wanted to do small, pocket-sized doesn't really cover what it is, but
sure.
An essay, a personal essay that would be able to be digested in maybe one or two sittings by the reader,
mm-hmm.
but would have a strong impact and be compelling enough to be captured in a small binding.
Well, it's very compelling, is from somebody who's read it.
So the first thing that happened was the publisher gave me the opportunity to write something. And it was a little bit of a challenge for me because, as we've talked about, I feel most comfortable as a poet. So my instinct as a writer would be to write as a poem, write poems or write as a poet. So I had to rely on my strengths as a poet to do it, but I also had to transition into being a nonfiction writer or practice my nonfiction a little bit more.
Because there was research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And therefore I also had to rely on actually things that I do as a teacher, encourage, going outside of yourself to find the inner stuff. Research is important as well. Once I figured out that I had enough of the pieces, including medical records, including my family's recollections, which were interesting because they didn't line up.
Memory is very different.
Memory is very different
from sometimes historical fact.
Right? Once I started to look at it as a puzzle that could be solved through writing rather than a puzzle that I personally needed to process, that's when I was able to say, well, this actually can work, first of all. And then I did have to take a little bit of kind of a leap of faith that other people would be interested too. And that's where I relied again on my knowledge of storytelling. my knowledge as a teacher, how would I tell a student to write a story like this? And kind of take the advice of the teacher to kind of put all the pieces together.
Well, you, as you described at the very beginning, and as we talked about at the beginning of our interview, you were a person who lived in her head. Mm-hmm. And this is a story of someone who loses that.
Right.
So that's you lose access to that very thing that defines you. And then as you reclaim it, reclaimed it and carried it further, so that not only were you able to access the things in your head, but you were able to share it and then help others as a teacher bring things out of their heads.
I hope that it can do that. As a writer of any kind, you want to connect to people, mm-hmm. and you hope that you will. And for me personally, I hope that I will not, because the story is shocking or amazing, whatever adjective you want to use, but so that they can look toward their own lives in some way. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to write a memoir yourself, but maybe you'll think more about the role of memory in shaping who you are. The people who shape you as much as the events that shape you. Some of those questions, like what did that time in my life mean for the person I am today, are just, you know, two-way streets that go back and forth. Am I the same person I would have been? I could never answer that question.
Right.
But that's okay for me. And I think that's something that time has given me, and I'm okay with the questions more than I might have been, certainly as a 19 or 20-year-old, where that experience was scary and frustrating, and I didn't know how it would turn out. Maybe it turned out well, so to speak.
Sure.
That was also a reason that I could write it now rather than certainly at the time.
At the time, or
after, yeah.
Right? You needed the benefit of hindsight to be able to look at that and then see how did that affect the rest of your life, which obviously you grew as a intellectually as a writer, mm-hmm. And to such a degree that you now teach it, mm-hmm. and you are a published author and poet. So it's having access to your memory, having access to your thoughts and words, that's an important part of who you are.
Yeah, you know, in some ways you need to be from a somewhat not detached, but a somewhat objective perspective to be able to look objectively and subjectively at yourself from such a long time ago.
Amy, for people who want to find out more information about your work, to find out more information about The Comet's Tale, where's the best places for them to go?
You can go to my website, aminaraki.org. You can also go to the publisher directly. Your favorite indie bookstore should carry it or be able to find it for you. And, of course, it's available most places online where books are sold.
Okay, so that's Amy Noraki. I'm going to spell it for people. AmyNaraoki.org. So that would be the catch-all website, mm-hmm. where you post a lot of your poetry.
I do.
Which is fantastic for fans of your poetry. It's a great place also to find your catalog of mm-hmm. your work, so people can find it there. Amy Noraki, thank you for coming here and being a part of Nutmeg Chatter.
Very good to be here again. Thank you.
Nutmeg Chatter is a production of WAPJ, Torrington Community Radio. Some of the music has been provided by the Jingle Punks, courtesy of YouTube Royalty Free Music, so we thank them for that. Please stay tuned to this station for more information, entertainment, and music, and we hope you enjoyed the chat.